WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. This is going to be a fun one. We're getting a Maryland Crab Cake Tour out on the road presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. Going to let ourselves play this week for Ukraine at Heavy Seas Brewery, doing a promotion there with our friends at the Coopers. But we're going to be at G&A Coney Island Hot Dog. We're going to be up in Greenmount Station in Hampstead doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by our friends at Goodwill, where they're also working with some job strategies. We had Lisa Raciniak on the program last week. I have waited to have D. Watkins on a long, long time. Tracked him down. He's always busy working on something for Salon, working on the next best-selling book, working on a television project with David Simon. I really appreciate that you've taken a little time to slow down, hang out with us a little bit, get to know us a little bit. I hope we do that. Do you eat crab cakes?
I eat crab cakes all of the time.
Right. Next time we get together, it's going to be over a Maryland crab cake. You know, Brandon drags me over to Coco, so I'm looking for some minority-owned places. I've been working, and I know you're about to do some work with the Banner. I've been working with Charm City Table and the blogging community to try to find some great new places, so you'll have to have the ear and the eye up. How are you? You've been working a lot of projects, man. I know you got a book going on. You're always doing something, but I guess first and foremost is this incredible TV series that's coming out. We had Bill Zorzi on. We have David Simon coming on in a couple of weeks. I had John Sheck on, who finished second to getting the gig, and Josh Charles got the gig. This is not an exciting project for Baltimore. It's a lurid tale, but it's something that obviously, given what you've done, the work you've done, having you in on this project allows some authenticity, I think.
I think it is an exciting project for Baltimore because if we just took some time to go beyond the content of the show and focus on thousands of people from Baltimore and some of the surrounding counties got a chance to collaborate and work on this project. Careers were birthed. People who weren't working over the pandemic were able to make money and feed their families. About 10 people I can think of off the top of my head are part of a union now. So some of my friends got their first opportunity to work in wardrobe on a major HBO project. Some other people got a chance to use this to jumpstart their careers to get actually get more work. And we got a chance to come together to tell our authentic story. And me being tied in with Thea Washington, who did all of the local casting, we got a chance to incorporate real victims, survivors of the Gun Trace Task Force to actually be a part of the project. So, you know, I think that is the part of the story that a lot of people leave out when they talk about Baltimore is being shown in this way. Baltimore is being shown that way. No, Baltimore is being shown in an authentic way. Baltimore is being shown the way Baltimore is for a lot of people. Just because it might not fit one person's view, you know, we all have to know that our view isn't the only view. But the big takeaway is the amount of careers and all of the local restaurants and all of the hotels and all of the people and all of the places and the big jolt of energy that has been given to the city from this project.
I've had Fenton on a couple of times, and obviously he's going to be working at the Banner now. And hopefully, you know, the more journalism, the more light, we're all working in the same way to try to make all of it better. And the only way it can be better is if it's on the up and up for everybody. And I had Soderbergh on as well. This story about dirty cops, and I'm from the east side of Baltimore. Jenkins is an EVT guy. I have Dennis Colazzos on all the time. Owens Coons Ford was an EVT guy. And The Wire and what that's represented for two decades here of this fictional account of Baltimore that may have a lot more truth to it, and certainly the depth and peeling back the onion of the series. But two decades later, here's something that is based on truth or based in truth. And certainly when you talk about real victims being part of the cast, being part of the dialogue and the way and the violent way all of this went down and done really being sanctioned by the state of Maryland, being sanctioned by the city, being sanctioned by everyone until it wasn't anymore. And for people unfamiliar with this story, and there are going to be people watching it on HBO all over the world, they're going to see this story as based on true events. What are they going to make of putting 5 hours into this over the next two months?
I think that they're going to be able to understand why so many people feel the way they feel about police and policing. A couple of things. So the first is, you know, people like myself, a survivor of police brutality has been talking about the problems with policing for a really, really long time. And a lot of times people just wrote off those things I said or those complaints is just, you know, for whatever reason they wanted to write it off, right? People have a right to, you know, believe what they want to believe and not believe whatever they want to believe, right? So I think they're gonna see why we feel the way we feel. And then on the other side of the spectrum, I think a lot of people who are super pro cop are gonna see how you can be rewarded in a department for being bad at your job. And this isn't just happening in Baltimore, this is happening across the country. When you put a lot of weight on the drug war, when you reward stats-based arrest, and you point those people to a lot of poor black and brown areas, you know, you kind of get what happened in Baltimore over and over again. So, you know, I think a lot of different people are going to see some problems with policing, and hopefully it'll change their language or their thoughts about what reform and change and abolition or whatever decision they decide to go into, what kind of language is needed based on the stories from victims on all sides.
Dee Watkins is a great, great writer and editor here in the city. He's been at work on the HBO project along with David Simon. The project comes out later on in the month. We're going to be talking about that on HBO. I want to talk about you, man. I've never had you on. I am shocked sometimes I bring your name. I think of you as one of the great Baltimore writers of this generation. The newspaper side of things, right? And the look, I started at the Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore News American, to try to make my name. All I ever wanted to do was be a sports columnist and be a writer and write one book. And, you know, all, and my life took a different turn. And I had, you know, a way that I perceived this to be. All this time, you had a completely different background in getting to be a writer and writing a book of true events in your life. I'm shocked at how many people, when I mention your name, if they're African-American, they know all about you. If they're a traditional New York Times, Washington Post writer, maybe they're familiar with you. But the online side of this has changed a lot of things. But there are still a lot of people not familiar with you. And so I want you to give a little bio as best you can for anybody in my audience. You know, I've heard of him. I saw his book at the DeHarco when I was going to buy ice cream. And I Googled him or whatever. I know he's Simon's buddy. But how did you get to this space? Because I every writer wants to be taken seriously. And I know when you began this, you're probably on a way different journey than maybe you pictured for yourself.
Absolutely. What I will say is that the writing came late for me, but I was always a person who was in love with storytelling. So I think my career was able to move kind of fast because I've been infatuated with stories and how they work and who tells them since I was a small child. Like I remember fighting my sleep, scared to go in the house because I was terrified that I was going to miss something. The dudes who stood at the top of my block, you know, I'm an East Baltimore guy too, and they would just tell some of the most. They would make a trip from Somerset, Lafayette Housing Projects, the corner store, Church Square, sound like they went to the moon, right? So many different things would happen. And the pacing was always good. And the funny was always, you know, it was always funny and it was always exciting. And it was always, wait, let me get to that part, right? It was always those different anecdotes that all great storytellers have.
It sounds like a Spike Lee joint to me, a little bit like
yeah,
that, right?
I was in love. I was in love with Do the Right Thing when I first saw it as a small child. Because
by the way,
what
a great movie, right? Like all these years later, if anybody says to me, "Go see a movie," I say, "Go see Do the Right Thing." That's a great place to start on trying to understand our country.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, that was me. And, you know, like a lot of kids from Baltimore, I came up in the streets. I grew up in the crack era, grew up selling crack.
How does that start? Can I ask you that? How does that begin for you? How old are you? 10, 12, 13?
for me, it started in my household. So, you know, I wasn't a kid who jumped out there as like an 8 year old, anything like that. But it was like everybody in my family was in and around it. It was the basis of my neighborhood economy. So any and everybody had something to do with it. If you wasn't using it, you were selling it, you was a lookout, you was a runner, you was a money man, you was a corner man, you wasn't a corner man.
Well, so there's a perception in the county from the people who feel that way that everybody in the neighborhood is in on it. And you're telling me maybe that there was no other economy, well, literally, right?
I'm not saying there was no other economy. I'm saying, people work for Hopkins, people work for the city, but I'm saying that it had a presence. It was there. It had a presence, and everybody didn't participate because the same way you had some wild stuff going on at my house, the lady next door went to church all day, and the people next door to them, they were black people, but they loved to do karate. They had black belts. And then the people down the street, you know, they might be, you know, I knew people that was Boy Scouts and the manga Dragon Ball Z. Like, it's, the complexities is very complex, but some houses and some parts of some neighborhoods, you have people who dibble and dabble. And that's kind of how I came up, man. I came up in the streets. I was able to have a few positive people in my life who wanted me to go to college and taught me how to, you know, get enrolled into a college. But college didn't really work out for me. And
where'd you go to high school?
Dunbar.
Dunbar. Okay.
Yeah. I went to Dunbar High School, and so all of my schools in Baltimore, I graduated from University of Baltimore with a bachelor's in history. And then I have a master's in education from Hopkins, a post-grad from Hopkins, and then an MFA from University of Baltimore. So, but I didn't make it back to college until I was in my mid-20s, I was able to walk away from the street stuff and kind of focus on trying to be educated and trying to do something positive with my life. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. When I first got into college, I took criminal justice because I'm like, yo, I'm a criminal and I want justice. So maybe I should just fuck with criminal. So maybe I should just mess with criminal justice. And it wasn't, you know, it was like, you know, all of this like police stuff. And I'm like, yo, what, like, what's happening? Like, I don't want to do this. So then I switched to history, and I love history. But while I was preparing to graduate in history, I had to go to the hospital. And when I went to the hospital, this is when I fell in love with words. A nurse was reading this book, and she was in my room with a book like this, right? And I've never seen anybody read a book like that. I'm in college, but I'm not seeing, you know, people read Spark Notes, people skim. People aren't doing deep dives.
I was a Cliff's Notes guy myself. I mean, don't tell yeah. Don Moeller, you know.
You know, so I'm like, yo, what are you reading? And, you know, she said, oh, you would love this book. And I'm like, yo, why would I love it? I don't love any books. She said, this book is about you, about me. She said, yeah, it's a book about thugs. I said, what? I'm not a thug. She said, well, explain those basement tattoos. Or better yet, explain why everyone who comes to see you smells like a bunch of weed. And I'm like, duh, they got cataracts. And she bust out laughing. And then I started laughing. She was a cute nurse, and it was some banter. I never got a number, but she left this book called The Coldest Winter Ever. And The Coldest Winter Ever just tells a story of a young woman who grew up in the streets, and she comes from a drug family, and just the things she had to face being in that environment, growing into womanhood. The misogyny, the peer pressure, and all of these different things. And I could just relate to a lot of it. So I read it. And then when I got out of the hospital, I started looking up, it was written by a woman named Sister Soldier. And I started looking up everything that Sister Soldier wrote. So I read her whole everything. And I'm finding out that, you know, she was inspired by people like Toni Morrison and, you know, James Baldwin, all the greats. So I'm reading them, and from reading them, I'm finding out about other people who was active throughout their careers. And now I'm reading On the Road and Naked Lunch. And then I'm finding out, you know, oh, wow. So they were inspired by Dostoevsky. So now I'm reading The Gambler and The Idiot. And I'm fucking, from reading books about the streets, I'm now knee deep in Russian literature. And I'm sitting on my block reading The Idiot.
What is this? Idiot, is this the turn of the century?
This is also all of this was happening in around 2000 and around 2008, 2009.
Okay. That's like recent to me. That feels very recent to me.
This is like 2008, 2009 to me. I went from a person who struggled to, you know, get through a book, to becoming a guy who just didn't really want to do anything with reading. And that's kind of how I started my career. I started reading the city paper. I started reading Baltimore Sun, started finding, things that I liked and that I didn't like. And instead of being the person, who complained about how my neighborhood was covered or certain parts of the city was being covered, I decided to be a person to contribute. So, I threw my hat in the ring and I took writing seriously. I didn't just jump up and start, you know, claiming I was a writer. I studied the greats. I went to a bunch of different events. I read voraciously. And then I repeated these things over and over again. And, then when it was, when I felt like I was getting close, I went and enrolled in an MFA program because I just wanted to take it to that next level. And while I was there, I finally started publishing some essays. And that's kind of when I got my first email from David Simon. He thought I wrote a good story. He thought the pacing was good. He thought it was funny where it needed to be funny and, you know, and angry where it needed to be angry. And I'm like, man, this isn't the real David Simon. This is somebody like,
did you watch The Wire when it was out? Or I mean,
I watched The Wire. I started watching The Wire during the last season. Right. But like, I didn't know, like, it's crazy because I watched The Corner with my dad. Like, one of the things me and my dad would do, in our turbulent relationship was we sat down and watched The Corner. Like we had a standing appointment to watch The Corner and we was mad when it was over, you know, because we just thought it was so good. We thought it was so good. I'm dealing with the streets like DeAndre McCullough's character. And he's dealing with addiction and recovery like Gary McCullough. And we locked in on that, right? So some years pass and I go in this whirlwind of a reality. And the crazy thing is, so a friend of mine, but two friends of mine, we were fighting someone else. And the guy I was with is like, yo, I kicked his ass. He looks like the junkie from The Wire. And I'm like, who's wearing a wire? He's like, no, The Wire. He's like, The Wire, the show. And I'm like, you watch that? And he was like, are you crazy? You don't? And I was like, damn, I don't even really, I haven't been watching TV like that. I was selling pills. So so I went to Soundgarden and I bought I bought the DVDs from Soundgarden and I sat down and watched it straight. And I was like,
I need to borrow them. It's not online. Yeah. I gotta find the damn thing. You know?
Baynard Woods just let me hold a box set of all the Homicide DVDs, right?
Okay.
And he probably thinks he's gonna get it back.
Hey, you know, I worked with Simon back in the 80s at the paper, right? So he and Rafael Alvarez were always up on the fifth floor late at night. I did the sports page. I did the scoreboard page, all the box scores from 86 to 92. And they were serious cats at that time. Then obviously Homicide happened and all of that. But it's amazing as I travel the world and I say I'm from Baltimore, how many people will mention The Wire, and not in a flattering way, right? But in a flattering way of, that's the greatest TV series in the history of TV series. And I know there was a thing that came out a couple months ago about that. I've never watched it. And people are like, how could you have you watched The Sopranos? Yeah. Have you watched Sex and the City? Yeah. No, I've never watched The Wire because I lived in Baltimore and I just didn't want to feel that portrayal of the city while I'm apart. I moved to the county about 2 months ago after 20 years downtown. At some point for the art part of it, I really need to sit, but I understand it's a commitment. It's a 50-hour, commitment, right?
I don't think that the portrayal is as negative as people make it. I think that people, they focus in, it's 50, like you just said, it's 50 hours, over 50 hours of television, right? And people focus on the most negative parts and they let that tell the story. You know, and it's just not that simple. It's not black and white. You have some people saying it's all negative. It's not true. You have some people who call it propaganda. It's not true. You have some people who say that it makes residents look a certain way. And it's still, it's not true. It is a collection of the many different systems that fail or don't fail this city and how they work.
It's or any very city. Smart, or any, it could be set in any city, right?
Or any city. It's a very smart. I'm not saying, like, I've said this before I even knew David Simon at all. I've said this on panels. I've said this in places where it wouldn't be popular. I've said this. The show is brilliant, transformative, and pretty much every show, especially cop shows, behind it on these big networks, bears its mark. It's undeniable. It's an undeniable show. For example, within the first five episodes, you know, it's a cop show. So you have police officers who come to work, pull their pants up, put their boots on and try to do their job. Then you have police officers who steal. Then you have police officers who are belligerent drunks. Then you have police officers who are racist. Then you have a police officer who busts the kid's eye open and his sergeant comes out and says, you felt like you and your fellow officers were in danger. This is all in the first five episodes. The same thing with the streets. You have people who don't want to do it, but they're in it. You have people who are just bystanders. You have people who are able to bypass it and move on and do other things with their life. And I can only say this with authority because I was outside for a long time. You go to Douglas Housing Projects, go to Latrobe Housing Projects, go up and down the hill, up and down Ashland Avenue, go to these places and ask people who I am, and they will tell you. So this is a firsthand experience. And I think, you know, a lot of times when people try to minimize it for like their Twitter friends or like their talking points, they're not being fair, or they never really fully engage the show, or they just don't understand how art works. It's a smart show. The close second to it, or the closest thing to it, I would say is Atlanta. Atlanta is really good. You know what I mean? These shows are complex. They're interesting. And they're well done. And you just got to give, you know, my favorite shows are The Wire, Atlanta, and Curb Your Enthusiasm. These are like my three. These are my
good thing you can afford HBO, huh?
Yeah.
Dee Watkins is here, author and hopefully new friend. Hopefully get a crab cake at some point and get out. I mean, you're busy doing a lot of stuff. I went to UB as well. And we talk so much about crime in the city, I had Tharu Vignaraj on last week and Brian Frosch. I mean, inside the city, outside, wherever it is. And there's no delay. I had Johnny O on. I live in the county. This crime doesn't stop. I'm not, guns, violence, murders, the gangs, all of these portrayals of the city, and then the evidence of dead bodies every morning, and that's been going on for generations here. In the middle of it for you, writing about it, being a part of, as you've said, a tough childhood, but where you are, what is the pathway to not fixing it, but putting us on a better track? What would that pathway look like, D?
So the big problem that people aren't going to say or invest in is abolishing handguns. that's the big one. Abolishing weapons, abolishing firearms. And I've said this before, and I get hate mail. You know, people love their guns more than they love.
I've been to Australia, so I mean, I hear you. You know what I mean? Yeah.
No, that's the big thing. You know, people say, "Well, we'll turn into the UK," and I'm like, "Well, you can run up on a crowd. You can shoot 10 people. You can't run up on a crowd and stab 10 people unless you're like Jackie Chan or something." You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, you got to be able to have some serious moves. That's the first thing, but. What can change is what we can work to change is working to abolish systemic poverty. How I grew up and the people I grew up around and how we were treated and what we've been through, we clearly, and I felt this way for a long time. I felt as if I didn't have a stake in society. So I would do whatever I wanted to do, whatever I wanted to do it, because I'm not hurting my city. This isn't mine. This is yours. I'm here, but I don't matter. So I'm going to move like a person who doesn't matter. And that is the problem. We have to make our residents feel like they have a stake in society. And right now, historically, And I'm not speaking about one leader. I'm saying leadership as a collective hasn't done a good enough job at making young people. And I'm talking at that prime age for crime, that 15 to 25, of making them feel like there's something for them here. There's a way for them to grow. There's a way for them to be successful. There's a way for them to buy real estate and to be educated and to make money and have opportunities. People don't feel like they get that. So this is why people respond the way they do.
Education in the city. You turned out okay in the end. It took you, you know, you had a path, but it was in the end you found it, or it found you. I've had Sonia Santelises. I mean, I've tried to make a career here in modern times of trying to find the smartest people I can find and just pick their brain as to how all of this is working for education in the city. Where do you lie on having a 6, 7, 8-year-old child, maybe with one parent, that the schools can be safe and effective and recruit the right kind of teachers who want to come in and lift the city? I feel like the city is lifted through children. And the older I get, the more I understand that.
I think that we have to, I think a lot of different systems, especially the school system, Dr. Santelises is brilliant. And, I think that we have to feel comfortable. And these are big things that I'm saying. I understand this isn't like, these aren't quick fixes. This requires a collective of people who's willing to challenge the status quo. We need to reimagine what public education is, what private education is, the hours our schools are open, what do they offer, what is the focus, and how students are being engaged.
What's the outcome? Are being engaged. Where do they get a job? What? Right? Literally, right?
I can literally, and you know, I hate using myself as an example or the people I came up around, but I can clearly remember people feeling like, yo, why would I go to school? Why would I be here? You know, especially if they didn't have a parent to force them, or if they weren't arrested for truancy. Why would I be here? Because there's nothing for me. There's nothing for me. The teacher's telling me, if your school doesn't have AC or your school doesn't have heat because, you know, you guys don't work hard enough. So you're not really giving the thing, you know, you don't get things like that. And then we're looking at the teacher like, well, you're in here without heat too. What did you do wrong? You went to college, you're a teacher. Why do you work in a building with no heat, right? And all of these things kind of add to people feeling like there's nothing there for them. So, you know, I think Baltimore City has some amazing teachers that they're way better than the teachers I had coming up. Some of my teachers were assholes, but I think Baltimore City Public Schools, and I'm saying this because I've made hundreds of school visits over the past 7 years, teaching workshops, giving away books, being the first writer that some of these young people ever met.
Up when you go and do that? Do you feel that future, or do you feel some despondency and search? I was asked to speak one time, long time ago, 20 years ago. You might have still been in high school at that time. I was asked to go over to Patterson High School and speak about sports. It was an academy. Yeah, you probably remember this, right? And they had a sports leadership thing. And they asked me, owning a radio station, and I was a young guy. I mean, I was probably 30, 31. And I went in, and it was demoralizing. I had stuff thrown at me. It was really like, it wasn't frightening, but it was like, why did I waste my day? The 20 kids in front of me had wanted no part of me. They didn't want to listen. And I was really demoralized by it for a long period of time. I'm like, I found that to be strange because when the speakers would come into my class, we were kind of happy they were there. It meant the teachers weren't talking.
Yeah, you got to get into a rhythm. I had some amazing visits and I had some visits that weren't so good. And it just, you know, the bigger thing is why you're doing it and how can you serve? And I've had visits that weren't great. And then I've had visits that I wish I could duplicate over and over again.
One or two kids, even that day at Patterson, there was one or two kids that really got my message, wanted my email, you know, like all of that. So if you get that, you really, if you move one kid, you've done something. So it wasn't like that, but I just in a general collective, I would hope that when you do these 700 visits that you're seeing a lot of brightness, hopefully from young people.
Yeah, some of my students have went on to go to that I've visited and had relationships with. Some of them are in college. My mentee got a book deal. You know, like quantifiable goals. And another guy who I work with a lot, he's running the arts and culture at the Banner, Lawrence Burney. So it's like
I met Lawrence. Hey, Lawrence, shout out.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, we and you know, I didn't mentor Lawrence, but I worked closely with him throughout his career to make sure every resource I had was his resource. You know, if you want to meet an editor, I can put you in that position. If you want to get an agent, or if you're thinking about hiring an agent, if you're willing to do the work, then I open my network up and then I challenge you to do the same for someone else. And we continue to push forward. But, you know,
that's community, man. That's beautiful.
Yeah. What I learned how to do was work with the schools and doing their job to make sure the business are like as powerful as possible. So one way was when I got affiliated with Penn Faulkner, they were buying copies of my books and they were giving them to the students to keep. And the teachers were teaching the books so that the students had an idea of who's coming to talk to them. So now, you know, you got a chance to read about the stuff that I write about as part of your curriculum. And then when I come up to talk, I'm not coming in blind. I'm not coming in as just some guy who has figured out, you know, how to live his dreams out. I'm coming in as a guy who you read, and now we can have a productive conversation about, and you might not want to talk about the book. You might want to talk about what is it like to work on a film or a television show. You might want to talk about what is it like to be a college professor. You know, you might want to talk about any of these things, and I can just pull up and have those conversations, and they tend to be pretty valuable.
He is the good professor and editor at large at Salon, D. Watkins. You can follow him at D. Watkins World out on Twitter. Part of the HBO project here coming up. And also, dude, we got to come back. I'll do Carmelo with you another time. I want to do Black Boy Smile with you for a minute because it's the new thing. You got pre-orders going on, and we'll – there you go. Hold it up. Sell it. Hold it up. Sell it, man. It's out. You're physically holding it, yes?
This is just a galley. This is – It doesn't come out until May 17th, but the week before it comes out, I'm going to have an event at Greedy Reads, and they're going to be selling some copies early. And I'm going to be in conversation with Maria Broom. I don't know if you know Maria Broom. But
I do know Maria. I want to know her.
She played on The Wire. She played on The Corner. She taught dance at the School of Arts in around Baltimore for a really, really, really long time. She's just a powerful woman, and she has a great energy. And I think we're going to have a meaningful, like a good conversation.
Tell me about the book a little bit. Sell it.
Black Boy Smile is moments of me learning, me succumbing to toxic masculinity and what I needed to do to be able to move beyond that bravado, that aggression, that anger. a lot of people are talking about what happened at the Oscars the other night, right? That need to feel like you're in control, to feel like you were the bigger person, you were the baddest person, you were the one who controlled the situation, and how dangerous that can be. It begins with me being challenged to fight and to battle and to war as a child, and how those early lessons led to me having a string of failed relationships, a string of failed friendships, and what I had to learn and unlearn and to be able to experience real happiness, to love my wife correctly, to love my daughter correctly, to be the person they need me to be.
Hey, man, congratulations on getting another book out. You're getting pretty prolific here, popping them out like Beatles albums at this point. You can follow D. Watkins. Last thing for HBO and on the series and people committing to watching this, make a case for people to watch this who maybe aren't familiar with the books. And you reference another author that's also a friend that's been on the program, that this story has been so grisly, so awful, on top of everything else that's ever happened in the city, that it's now going to be chronicled by local people with authenticity. But dedicating 5 hours is a little different than 50 on The Wire. But this could have easily been 20 hours.
6 hours.
It's 6 hours. Six okay. Hours. Well, this could have been 20, right? I mean, I don't know how it got to six. I thought it was five. So I have to put an extra week aside for you now. But why six episodes? And just paint the picture of a commitment, because I'm committed to watching it. I want to see your work. I want to see David's work. I've never seen The Wire, but I'm committed to this. I'm not afraid of this. And I think I can bite it off in the next month and a half.
I think for this show, I think people who are curious as to how bad cops are rewarded for being bad, you know, should watch, because it's a big learning experience. It'll teach you how one of the most funded, at one point, staff departments had a group of guys committing atrocious things right in front of everybody while winning awards and medals. And you'll get to understand how that is, how that can happen. And then on the flip side of it, you'll get to see how victims, you know, survivors actually have to live with these people. And it'll just add another layer to the conversation.
The amazing part for me was the greed of action of how many crimes were you going to commit systemically before there's an end, one way or another, right? Like it seemed to me a crooked cop once would be awful, right? Like that, just if that happens one time, but getting away with it over and over and scheming a system to get away with it, is something that I'm really, you know, having read about it, now I want to see your portrayal of it. Dee, I appreciate it. You've been very kind with your time. Thanks for making some time. I know we've misconnected at various points, and you're super duper busy teaching the kids and all that stuff, but please come on, have a crab cake again sometime soon, all right?
Yeah, where's your favorite spot to get crab cakes at?
Oh, see, now you're getting into me here. So, well, we did the show at Fadley's last week, and I would just say this on crab cakes. See, when it comes to crab cakes, they're just different, right? So Fadley's has that mustardy thing. I like it fried, so I like it that way. They serve it a little more room temperature. Costas has a great East Side crab cake with that combination of sort of sweet and the Old Bay. I know Brandon loves his Coco's, and that's more along the sweet line, and we've been there. Conrad's Crabs, Pappas. We're moving all around the Beltway, so I've had a lot of crab cakes. The best crab cakes I've had were in August of last year. I did 30 crab cakes in 30 days in 24. I did one in every county around the state. And the ones on the Eastern Shore in August, because a lot of the places are literally pulling female crabs out of the water on the spot, picking them there. You're getting that roe, that orange roe in there, that sweet female meat that's sweeter than the male meat. They pick the female crabs. They table the male crabs, right? So when you get a crab cake over at Old Salties on Hooper's Island, or when you go to Suicide Bridge over in Hurlock, or any of the Ocean City places where they're literally crabbing in the morning and you're eating that crab meat in a crab cake in the afternoon, there's just something about that that everybody should do and experience. So there. And get an ear of corn on a cob while you're doing it.
Yeah, you let me know. I gotta stretch out a little bit more.
All right, man. We'll get you out. Dee Watkins. He is Dee Watkins World. He's everywhere and writing books. New book, Black Boy Smile, comes out in middle of May. And obviously the television show and his HBO work is a part of a writer with the new series coming out in April. We Own This City, correct?
We Own This City. Yep, you got it.
I love it. Appreciate it, man. Dee Watkins here. It's another one of our Wise Conversations brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. We always appreciate their support as well as we get this Maryland Crab Cake Tour out on the road. Working with our friends for Ukraine in the Pravda Brewery, drinking some delicious American Red Ale. We're going to be at Heavy Seas Brewing this week with Hugh Sisson, also Patrick Russell. Got my friend Greg Vetter coming over from Tessie Mays. Nice local dressings, making it right, making the salads right. So we're going to have some great conversations about Ukraine, lifting in the city, and beer, which is one of my favorite things. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.